Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a rummage through the nuggets of magic that are arts and culture across Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we dig deep among the acetate to find meaning in the art of the record fair. We stare into the swirling wonder of Brum-based genre splicers Pram as they launch a long-awaited new album, and we take a reflective look back at the last 100 years through an engaging theatre project at Coventry Cathedral. If you would like to catch up on previous shows or have an idea for a future feature, check out our website, www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. We start with our passion in boxes as I met up with collectors, buyers, traders and vinyl advocates at Mac Birmingham's recent record fair.
Michael, have you had a chance to delve into the discs yet?
Not inside yet, no. Going to go in a bit.
So what sort of things are you looking for? Are there particular things?
Anything by Michael Jackson, Whitney, Billie Holiday, stuff like that.
And is that quite collectible now? Or?
Michael Jackson stuff is. Anyone who's dead, basically. Okay. That's only bad. Yeah. Anyone who's dead.
And it adds, I guess that sort of adds a bit of mystery as well as a bit of value, doesn't it? That kind of posthumous collection stuff. And what about your collection at home? The kind of what sort of vinyl have you got? Have you got lots?
Hundreds.
Hundreds?
Hundreds of vinyl, yeah. Absolutely loads. Anything from 60s, 70s to vinyl that I bought yesterday, years and years, album.
And did that start from a young age? Have you always had vinyl?
Sister was always buying vinyl. I think my first album was Saturday Night Fever, the soundtrack. Still got it.
That's a good
still
choice,
mint.
Isn't it?
Yeah, still mint.
And do you listen to, I mean, I guess you listen to lots of different formats and lots of different, you know.
7 inches, 12 inches, 33s, the lot.
I guess you listen to sort of DVDs and CDs and MP3s, do you?
CDs a lot as well, yeah. It's a shame they don't do CD singles anymore.
They've stopped
because they were
that,
good,
they?
Yeah, which is a shame. And 7 inches, which is hard to find at the moment.
And do you follow sort of record fairs across the country? You travel?
Yeah, definitely. We went to one in Coventry a couple of weeks ago. Here today, I'm virtually next door to Discovery on Bristol Road, and they sell absolutely everything.
Now, one thing that I do, I'm keen to work out whether this is something else that other people do, is I always look for things I've got. Do you see what I mean? To see,
yeah.
I think, oh, that's quite valuable. Or I think, well, I got three of those, it can't be that rare. Have you got sort of a couple of approaches? You're kind of looking for rare things, but checking out what you've got as well?
Definitely, yeah, all the time. If the record label's slightly different and the album's exactly the same, if it's been made in, say, Japan, and the record label's slightly different, then yeah, I'll buy that.
Excellent. Well, I will let you get back to all those rare things and hope you find what you're looking for.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, thanks.
Take care.
Thank you. I'm with Baz, who's one of the stall holders here at the record fair, record market.
Yep.
So, Baz, how's it going so far?
It's all right. Not a bad morning so far. Yeah.
And what are people kind of hunting out? Is there anything in particular?
It's been, from this stuff, it's been the rarer kind of alternative, industrial kind of gothy bits that I've got.
That sounds so, quite niche already.
Yeah. I think that they had specific wants, and I'd even had quite a few VHS videos that went, which was surprising. I just thought of bringing down the off chance, but about 15 of those went. So
wow, so they've obviously got some kind of top-loading video at home.
They've got something, yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And are there formats that sort of sell better than others? Do 12-inch singles, for example, sell more albums?
To be fair, it's the first one I've ever done. I've just got like a collection at home that's been built up over years, and it's just time to make some space to, you know, to free up some space at home.
So how have you done that? Have you gone about letting go, setting free some of your
I've had to reconcile that I can get it all. Basically, I've got a list of it. I've catalogued it all. I've worked out that if I want to hear it, I can get it on digital media of some format. But I can put this towards something like, because I'm growing old now, like a new floor or a new bookcase or something, you know, something practical. So put these things in, where it's easy to just sat here. I haven't got a record player anymore. So it was a labour of love when I was a teen and a student collecting it. But now it's time for someone else to love it like I have, and put the money towards something more useful.
And there are some folks, I think that's very noble, there are some folks who will say it's not the same, you know, the digital version's not the same as the album. What do you say to them?
It's a tricky one with me because I'm a sound engineer, so I come from the technically knowing. It's almost like I went to college with a load of photographers, and we all said the same thing. It's like it's difficult to listen to to music sometimes without being critical of it, and they said they'd do things like walk past a billboard post and they couldn't, you know, help but analyse the picture sort of thing. So I know technically that a CD, it's like it's a much narrower squash bandwidth, so I'll always prefer the thing of vinyl, but I'm also painfully aware of its potential pitfall sort of thing. But I think digital media's been a good thing, is that it's brought music to a huge mass market. I think people have a much more ready access to it. It can only be a healthy thing. Whether or not it's a profitable thing for the record industry and the artist is an entirely different question. But I think, you know, there's clearly a place now. Vinyl's back in fashion, it's being bought again. There's clearly a place for all of it, and it's a great thing.
So you're letting go of some of your prized possessions, as it were. Are there things, you're still buying vinyl? You're still buying new vinyl?
No, not really. Since the whole craze has come back in, I've not listened to a new one, to be fair, to this new, the heavyweight vinyl. Mainly because I've got a record player.
That is a prerequisite, isn't it, I think?
It's kind of, like a major prerequisite, So, but again, like, if I want to access stuff, I'll get hold of it digitally, I can just be able to hear it. Whereas before it was a labour, I wanted to hold, and I wanted the tactility of fielding like a nice big cover or a booklet, or, and the whole sort of ritual of putting something on the turntable. Whereas now, probably a victim of modern life, I just want everything.
There is that kind of relationship thing, isn't there, with the record?
Yeah.
Where, it's very tactile.
Very much so.
It feels and it smells.
Yeah.
And you kind of have that association.
Yeah.
And I was thinking personally, for me, I've got a lot of records that kind of take me back to a particular point in time.
Absolutely.
Have you got particular records that do that?
I was lucky enough when I went to, when I studied at university in Manchester, there was a band, Manchester band called The Chameleons. And it just so happened that somebody up there, was a record and tape exchange. And nearly every time I went in there, somebody seemed to be selling off their collection of ultra rare records, week by week. So it was, I'd go in there, another one would be there, the other one I wanted would be there. So it very much for me encapsulated that period of time in my life. And also, a lot of the vinyl I've got on sale for here has got stickers on from Record and Tape Exchange in Notting Hill in London. And that, for me, was my gap year, spending most lunchtimes going down there, driving from work, and then spending hours flicking through the, the records to buy stuff. So it's all very much got a place and time for. I've got a few of those, and Right Price. I've got our Price, Woolworths, all sorts. We're around in the days when those places that existed.
So are you setting out on doing lots of record fairs?
It's because you obviously got to pay to have your stall and that. So I said, I'm just looking to try and free up some capital to do other things. So it depends how I get on today, what's left. And obviously the quality of what's left, then, whether it's worth going on and doing another one. But so I'll have to wait and see how I do.
Excellent. So, I wish you luck.
Thank you.
Also, you can rest easy, because when you get home, there'll be more space.
There will.
You can breathe easy, but also you can put a hard drive where you had
exactly. Exactly.
But Baz, thanks very much.
No problem.
Bob, first thing I want to ask you about is this large box in front of me here, labelled Horror. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that where you keep the Kylie Minogue singles?
No, it's not. It's where mainly film soundtracks.
And is that a popular thing that people collect?
Some people do. Yeah. Mainly goths.
Mainly goths. So is it kind of, Hammer House, that kind of stuff?
It'll be Hammer and the Wicker Man's in there, and there's all sorts of zombie albums and that. They're very popular.
Now let's talk about the kind of stock that you've got. You've got a broad range of different things. Are there things that are more popular than others?
I think generally speaking, it's mixed rock from the 70s seems to be the in thing at the moment. Progressive music, certainly Northern Soul, and some aspects of jazz as well.
Okay, so
but mainly it's the mixed rock, the classic rock people like Fleetwood Mac, Springsteen are selling, they're very popular still.
And what about yourself? How long have you been sort of doing record fairs? And
30 years.
30 years?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Straight out of school, obviously.
No, not quite, no, if only, yeah.
So what got you into that? How did you get into that trade?
Well, I was always interested in music. Funnily enough, when I was at school, we used to swap records around and get stuff from the charts and everything, And when you were at school back in the late 60s and that, the common thing was to have a piece of vinyl, which was like the Beatles or the Soul single and that, go back to somebody's house, play, and I picked it up from there, really. And then I think everybody's in love with things from the past anyway.
There is a kind of nostalgic aspect.
There is a nostalgic thing. There's a collecting side. People like the music, but there's also a collecting side to it, which is like almost very similar to antique collecting, really. The older the better isn't always the main thing. Rock and roll and some country and western and old 50s stuff is quite hard to sell at the moment. Yeah.
Is it more about scarcity in terms of numbers of pressings, that kind of stuff?
Or? Possibly, yeah. Scarcity does add a tremendous premium to the price of a record.
I'm told, one thing I've read that's quite sought after, it's a David Bowie record, a Diamond Dogs album, where the dog has something between his legs that he shouldn't have. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard about that one.
Yeah. It's quite rare, apparently. Yeah, only about 200 pressed.
It could well be something.
Have a look out there, for that one. Have a look
out for a new one on me.
The dog's dying.
I have to get my get my search engine going on that one.
So, what about yourself? What kind of personal collection have you got? Have you got a large hoard at home?
I've probably got about 600-700 singles, maybe 1,000 albums. That's about it. So I've got quite a bit of memorabilia as well, concert programs and stuff like that. So I've got a fair bit. Some people have got in here probably got much larger collections than that. Yeah,
I've noticed that there are sort of programs and posters and those kind of things. Is that a building market?
It's popular. It is popular. In fact, in some aspects, it can be more popular than vinyl. It's like concert programs from the 60s, for instance, a lot rarer than the albums. They again carry quite a high price.
I guess they're sort of throwaway things, aren't they? People wouldn't have thought at the time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Tickets as well, they must always have, the programme must always have the ticket with them.
Excellent. Now, just finally, a question I've asked a couple of other people. Is there a sought-after piece of vinyl that you either have or you'd like to possess?
Now, that's a very tricky one,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is a tough one. I probably would like to possess Please Please Me album by the Beatles. Gold Parlophone stereo, which is probably worth about 12 grand at the moment.
So it's worth having for a number of angles, aren't so I'm with Steve, and Steve, you've got a kind of bulging carrier bag,
two bulging carrier bags,
full of vinyl
but you've
kind of got two hats on, haven't you, in some ways, because you're a kind of collector and a dealer, is that
that's
right?
Correct, yes. I used to have a shop in Birmingham a few years ago, so now I just do it on the internet and buy for myself, but primarily very narrow based. I deal in jazz, soul, funk, reggae. So
folks listening, would they know that shop? Would they remember that shop?
Some might. It was called Same Beat. It was at the back of the station, and then for a few months, about 18 months down in Digbeth.
Okay.
So and then we went on the rag market for 3 years till they knocked it all down and moved us out of Birmingham. So and then I found the internet, and overheads are a lot cheaper. But I find myself to all the record fairs and know most of the dealers now,
How did you get into that world? How did you step into the record
store? At the age of 16, I left school and got into the music scene, going to clubs and that, found my niche, the music I liked. And then years later, a friend of mine was doing a record fair and asked me if I could take him. His car was broke down and he was selling his own personal collection, same music I loved. And I saw what he was doing. I thought, God, that's good. I know this music. I know I can find it on car boots or whatever. So I started from there and built up until eventually decided to open a shop in Birmingham.
So I guess that helps, doesn't it? Like anything, if you're selling something, if you've got a knowledge or a passion for it, does that help?
I'd say, the passion's a big thing. That's why I primarily stick to the music I love. Because that way I come to the record fairs, I enjoy looking at the music that still stirs me.
So obviously there are things in your mind that connect you with your youth and your great days.
Oh, God, plenty of them.
So that's kind of part of your programming, I guess, when you're looking for things.
It's changed a lot. When I was clubbing and that, seeing a lot of the bands were known, James Brown, Curtis Mayfield. But having actually got into the music I used to go down London a lot selling. You start to get into the vibe there, into a lot of Brazilian music, African music, European jazz, and my whole sort of record collection has changed from when I was a child, younger lad. I've cleared out a lot of the stuff I listened to then and into probably what you call some heavier stuff now.
Now, you say that like it's easy. I think letting go of vinyl is quite difficult, isn't it?
Not when you're a cello, you become more ruthless. I've got that much vinyl stored that my own personal collection now is CDs, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Because I've just got thousands of records for sale on the internet. Space becomes a thing with vinyl.
Yeah, so there is more of a balance now, isn't it? I think a few years ago, people would think it was, you know, sort of sacrilege if you listen to anything else but vinyl, you know. But people listen to all things, you know, phone or on a CD.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously changed. Obviously, the electronics, buying music electronically, I've got no sort of input into that. I can't do anything with that. So
what sort of things have you been acquiring today? Have you got any special things?
I'm
going to rustle through the bag now.
Top one here. That was a lovely find. Jimmy Casterbunch. It's just begun. A lot of the early electro sort of hip hop and that, we're really into that. So that's always been a good seller. You see all these break dancers normally use that tune off there as one of their mainstays.
Did you break dance yourself?
No.
Not yet?
No, not never been the best dancer, I'm afraid.
And are there things, when you're sort of rooting through the boxes and finding things, are there things that you find that you can't get online or electronically? You know, sort of, is that a rarity as well?
There's always going to be stuff. I mean, people are just digging for music all the time. As I say, over the past 20 years, African music's become very big in the scene. I mean, a lot of stuff out of Nigeria and countries that sort of West Africa, and you can't find those things, you know, unless you're going to go over there. A lot of them being reissued, and that's where you find them. I mean, to hear new music, especially in an area like Birmingham, the best way I've found of doing it is you just take a chance, buy a compilation, go from there.
Okay, so I'm with Roop, and we're hiding behind several boxes of 12-inch records of different varieties. So Roop, let's start by talking about how you got into all of this in the first place.
It was completely by coincidence. I did a boot sale back in the late 70s, early 80s, just selling my record collection. And I did it over a few weeks and got to know a guy who was buying them regularly, who was a record dealer. So in the end, I used to start looking for stuff for him from jumbo sales, charity shops, that sort of thing. And unfortunately, he passed away, left me with a few boxes of records. And so I started doing record fairs.
A bit like panning for gold, I guess, was it?
It was a bit like that.
And do you do fairs across the country?
We're going up to Scotland in October. We do Manchester, we do Bristol, we do London. So yeah, we travel around. Yeah.
And where are you based, sort of physically?
We're based in Cheltenham.
In Cheltenham.
Yeah.
So not too far from Birmingham, but
no, but far enough. It's about an hour or so from home. But yeah.
And logistically, how easy is it to transport the boxes and boxes of things? Because these are very fragile things, aren't they?
They are. The boxes, I've got two sizes of boxes. One that carries about 100 discs, 100 albums, and that weighs roughly £40 a box. I've got here on this store probably about 4,000 records.
Wow.
So I do have a van specifically for... Yeah, I do worry about getting being overweight, but I've got the heaviest van that I can buy on drive on my license. So.
And you've got quite a mix of music, haven't you? You've got a bit of everything, I guess?
Yeah, we try to cover all genres of music. My music of choice is prog and psych from the late 60s to early mid 70s. But we do across the board. We've got a bit of jazz, some reggae, new wave, indie, Britpop, heavy metal. That's a very good sale of heavy metal.
Do you source that from? Are you still rummaging through car boot sales and charity shops? Or?
I tend not to do that sort of thing anymore. Boot sales are too cutthroat for me now. If you find a box, you've got a queue of people waiting to jump on you. So I do advertise for records, and I do pay quite good money for records. I do get a lot of people come to me.
And what about your personal collection at home? Have you got a cave or a vault full of possessions?
Well, I always tell people that I don't collect records myself. There are a few that I hold on to for longer than others. So I've got a little room that I work in, and so I very often put my favourite discs on, and I play quite a lot to make sure they play right, particularly the expensive ones. Yeah.
And just finally, folks that haven't been to a record fair before, and it's I would say it's very easy to spend money.
Yeah.
But what tips would you give people? What in terms of starting a collection or seeking things out?
buy the best you can afford, best quality you can afford, because a lot of people will, they say they want a record, say a Kate Bush record, and they'll see one and pay, you know, £5 for it, and there's a few marks on it, and then they'll find another one, you know, in better condition. So don't be in a rush to part with your money. Just really sort of check over the disc before you part with your money and try and buy the best that you can afford. Best quality disc, anyway.
I think that is sound advice. So, Rupe, thanks very much for talking to me.
No problem. Thank you. Cheers.
Very much new curiosities now as we explore the energetic mist that is Pram. After a brief 11 years away, I caught up with band members Sam Owen and Max Simpson to talk about their sound, approach, and brilliant new album, Across the Meridian.
I'm with Sam Owen and Max Simpson of Pram, and great to be with you, because I know it's a busy period for Pram. You've been smouldering away in the background, and a bit of a, I guess, a hiatus in some ways, but you've been charging your energy, and excitingly, at the end of last month, a new Pram album appeared, which is Across the Meridian. And if folks listening haven't listened to it yet, we're going to play a couple of tracks from it, but I would urge them to seek out a copy. Sam, let's start with the album and the title, Across the Meridian. There's a kind of an exploration in that title, I think.
Definitely. I think there's... whenever we create a new album, we start with a lot of disparate songs we've been playing for a while and bring them together, but then we always find connections between them, and then from that really comes both the titles of the songs, because we always, every band has crazy working titles for their songs that they can't possibly make public, so we find song titles that are going to mean something for that song, whether it's instrumental or lyric based, and then somehow out of that we get the title of the album. And I think this album, like some of our others, is kind of about places, whether real or imaginary, and about journeys and spaces in between, I think. So hence, Across the Meridian.
There's a concept of meridians as being these kind of lines across, you know, they're imaginary lines that go around the world, and many things are meridians, you know, but and time and space and place. And what we're talking about is something that's going from one sort of space of certainty to somewhere of uncertainty. And it's all to do with, you know, how we create our art and how we make the music that we make. And we, a lot of our tracks and lyrics and ideas inhabit imaginary places.
Those are kind of popular themes at the moment, aren't they? Sort of boundaries and lines and lines that are being crossed or redefined. So it's kind of, and a number of the folks I've spoken to, certainly in the last few months, have touched on those subjects. Do you think you've sort of by osmosis taken on sort of those popular themes, or have you kind of come to them from different places?
I think it's always hard to know what you absorb and what's going on around you. I mean, this album's been quite a long time in the making. Previous albums have kind of touched on similar themes about journeys and place. And I think we've always been fascinated by strange or places that are somehow difficult to get to in your mind or in reality. So we've had an album called North Pole Radio Station, for example.
So it's 11 years since your last kind of studio album, which is quite a time, isn't it, really? Was that a kind of conscious thing to have that kind of gap, or was it just that people were sort of wanted to do different things, went off to do different projects, or, you know, like most creative endeavours, bands kind of, you know, go through phases. You know, did you intend perhaps to have that kind of break, or...?
We've been working on a lot of projects in the meantime, both as a band, as Pram, and also all been involved in our own projects together or with other people. But most of those have not necessarily resulted in something that's been recorded. Some have, and some have fed into the songs on the album, but some have been performance-based. So, for example, we did... we work a lot with a filmmaker called Scott Johnson, who did the Forwards project.
Yes, which, where we met, yeah.
So Forwards being one of the projects we've worked on, but also with Scott, we did a big project called Shadow Shows. We started with a residency in Germany where we developed it. We got to wander around their lovely castle in a place called Sigmaringen and do some filming. And that was a a live performance where the music, us as musicians, were standing behind a screen on which were projected shadows and film, and then we were shadows projected onto the screen. So it was, and playing live. So it's quite a slightly different thing for us, and that we did that at Edinburgh Film Festival and Supersonic and Flatpak here in Birmingham.
And we've worked on individual ones, like me and Sam have been involved with a thing called the Sound Books Project, where we've worked with artists who are based in Wales, making effectively music with books. And it's quite a strange and different project. Matthew's been involved with a lot of projects, hasn't he? And he works in theatre doing sound design. And Harry as well, he's been doing lots of projects. So basically, yes, we've all got our own different projects. So some of the Pram Stuff projects have meant that we kind of, it's sort of made, we were always putting this record together, but it's kind of made it just extend and extend and extend. So it's been hard to get together and sort of finish it off until recently.
Now let's talk about your sound, because just before coming to interview you folks, I read a lot of reviews and a lot of things about Pram, and I kind of thought, people are struggling to define what kind of music Pram make as a band, okay? And I picked out some of the choice versions. So experimental is definitely a word that comes up, and soundscape is another that comes forward. Ambient is one that people use a lot, but here's my shot at describing your style of music. Okay, I kind of thought impish is a word. Ooh. I would use.
Never had that one before.
Yeah,
but
that's a good
I
like
one.
It. So I get that one in. Quirky, I think some people use that before. And I think the two other words I would use, one is undefined, and that is, I mean that in a positive way, in the sense that it really is very difficult to put your music into a bracket or into a box. And the other word, hopefully you'll like this one, is searching, because I think there's something about your music where it does make you think, and it does make you sort of contemplate. It's always difficult for bands to put themselves in a box or describe their genre. So how, when you're endeavouring to make records, what's in your mind in terms of styles? Is it just creatively what comes?
Yeah, that's a tricky one, because, obviously it's creatively what comes, but in certain ways it's about retelling stories in our heads. Very much been influenced by, like, old films and interesting literary, sort of themes. So, we don't go searching to create or recreate a generic type of song, but obviously we're influenced by lots of different genres. And it's not a conscious, we're going to do this, we'll just work towards that. It's sort of, each of us initiates songs in very different ways, and quite a lot of the time we come with ideas and even like sort of sound collages that we then, other members of the band, interweave their own ideas and we build layers. That's kind of...
Yeah, I quite like the idea of impish, because I think there's a playful element, and I think that's true of any creative musician or artist. If you're going to produce something new, you have to be able to play and explore ideas. So I like impish. And and searching is also part of that, of course.
Well, I'm glad you like that. I read a terrible one, which was revisionist electronica.
Okay.
We're waiting for the show trial.
You could probably get prosecuted for that. Yeah, I imagine. Yeah. So, Max, you picked up there on something I wanted to explore a bit more, which is this idea of kind of collage of sound. There's a brilliant French word, bricolage. Okay, for our French listeners, they know what that means. To us, it means DIY shops, but it's actually a bit more than that. I think it's about pulling sort of disparate things together to make a whole, I think. Absolutely. And one of the things I wanted to explore really was sort of sampling and the use of sampling in your work. I think there are a lot of artists and a lot of acts who are able now quite readily to use, clips and digital recordings. And I'm just curious how you go about finding things and using things, and whether, what the kind of process is for keeping things in and leaving things out.
I mean, to a large extent, what we've used is, what's been to hand. And this can be anything from the soundtrack to just a piece of music to found footage to our own field recordings. One of the things we did with the Forwards Project was a lot of field recording with people. Mm. And that's a great way to, use the rhythms, unusual sounds, unusual melodies even, you know, and then to create stuff from that, to use that as a starting point. You know, we've done everything from using, like, on the album we've got a track, we took a sample from a Duke Ellington track that we use, but we've also used one from a Bollywood film, we've used some field recordings. It's a whole mishmash, but the idea is to create something that, you know, gives a whole atmosphere. Atmosphere is as important as just a kind of rigid rhythm or melody structure.
The first track from the album that was kind of featured by the record label, as almost like a single, we don't really get singles these days, but yeah, Shimmer and Disappear, we had a particular idea which came, Shimmer and Disappear, the title was kind of mirages and again places, things that are there and not there. But the person who did the video, Claire Evans, who me and Max have worked with on animation in the past, soundtracks to animation, she did some stop motion animation, very much in the style of Oliver Postgate, that kind of thing. And the thing that came into her head was a space journey with a cat and a girl who go to this crazy planet where there are
space hermits
who are in need of water for their planet. So this cat and girl bring water to their planet. So that was in her mind, completely different.
It's a wonderful video, but it was she'd taken a different thing from it than we had, you know, which is great.
You can check that out online, but for now, here is Shimmer and Disappear. Now, you talked earlier about place and about space. I know you went and hid away, really, in Wales, I think, to record most of the record, and in fact some things that might make another record, which is exciting, I think. Literally sort of locked yourselves away remotely, sort of cut off from the world. Did that help sort of channel your thinking and sort of a bit of clarity? Was that the idea?
We'd already had a lot of the ideas and a lot of the music, but like everybody nowadays, we were finding it very difficult to find time or to get away from distractions or the daily routine. And although we did a lot of recording here in Birmingham, we just realised that we needed to go somewhere where we were out of contact. And the Foale studio, which is in, you know, sort of like a rural Wales, it's great because you can't even get phone reception there. So we could just, you know, we went and stayed there and, you know, they have accommodation there and recorded there. And it was just brilliant because we'd get away from everything and really concentrate and focus.
So it gave us the opportunity to actually do a bit of improvisation and again, playing really. And from that, some of the we came up with some new tracks for the album, which then we took back to our studio here in Birmingham and then spent another several years messing around with.
Yeah, so that must have been a refining upon refining, I guess. Sort of super refinement, if that's the word.
It's always hard to know when to stop, really.
But we got the original idea for doing that was actually this, the other recording that you're talking about was actually not in Wales, but in Germany. We've been invited by Joachim of Faust to his studio in Germany, in his Klangbad studio. And there is a fantastic place. It's like in an old, it's sort of like an old warehouse type complex. I'm not quite sure what the original buildings were, but there was some sort of like factory or commercial building. And he has like the space, a studio to record in. And that's where we realise this is what we need to do back in Birmingham. Although that record hasn't actually been released yet, so that isn't actually finished. But that was what gave us the whole idea of doing that.
Let's talk about another track on the album. One that really sort of stood out to me was Ladder to the Moon, which is a fantastic title. And there's a kind of, I guess, a jazz inflection on it in some ways. So tell me a little bit
about
that.
Very much so. I was saying before, this is the one Georgia
O'Keeffe.
Her painting, Ladder to the Moon, was what inspired us because it's the idea of the space between, you know, this world and another world. And we're very, you know, kind of, we were talking earlier about the recently rediscovered John Coltrane album. We are, you know, kind of influenced by that kind of stuff. And so it was just our take, you know, it's our kind of jumble sail jazz. So yeah, it's a meditation on that, really.
Let's hear a bit of that now. Now, That was Ladder to the Moon by Pram, and Sam and Max are with me here. A lot of the press that came out when the new album appeared was around, there's a description of an unexpected reunion. So people thought that Pram had gone away and gone forever. But were there particular drivers that brought you back together, or sort of things that sparked off?
We were never away. We were always there.
It was just literally finding the time and space to finish the album. So there was no kind of, we never stopped. It's just people, you know, as you progress in life, you get more commitments and more things that kind of get in the way of doing some of the things that you want to finish.
So but also nice commitments, like
the
Forwards Project.
Yeah. The good stuff.
It's been some great projects.
And in fact,
projects.
I think there is a recording from the Forwards Project that will come out at some point.
You've also been touring and playing some live shows, and you had a kind of launch party, I think, in Birmingham at The Edge. I think it was at The Edge.
There's
a fabulous club that goes on there regularly called Club Integral, and they just put on the best stuff. They put on really interesting acts. It's very eclectic. You don't see just purely generic bands. You do, or whenever they put stuff on, it's always something that takes you somewhere else, somewhere really interesting. And so when it came to launching the album, we thought it'd be the perfect place, so we asked them and they were very up for it. So
it was kind of a collaboration between Club Integral and Friction Arts, are the people that run The Edge, who did the recent project around the wholesale market. So really involved in community groups around Birmingham. So it was a dream sort of combination for us to do a gig there. And
right time, right place.
That's
what you need, I think, in show business, isn't it?
Indeed.
I was going to ask you about audience responses as well, in terms of, you know, obviously you've got a home crowd following, which is natural. And I think you played, was it Lexington in London?
That's right.
What kind of responses you had from people in terms of, you know, the kind of live show? I don't mean people run out screaming, but hopefully not.
No, just tremendous. Just really, really overwhelmingly good, positive, you know, excited responses, which is great, you know, because you know, feel like you've been out of circulation for a while. You never know what you're going to get, but it's fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah, we played the Soup Kitchen in Manchester as well, and we're looking at some gigs either later this year or early next year, so those are TBC, but we're excited about doing more shows live. We really enjoy it.
Excellent. Well, we can find out more, I think, on your Facebook page, can't you? Right. There's all kinds of weird and wonderful things on there. And just finally, I just wanted to ask you, we talked about some of the material, perhaps, from other recording sessions that might appear as an album and some of the Forwards work. Have you got things in mind for perhaps film or collaborations, some of the things you've touched on? What have you got lined up next for Pram? Not another 11-year break, I hope.
No, not at all. No. Like we say, we've got this album that was recorded at the Faust Studios in Klangbad, and that's we're still just mixing it, basically. But yeah, that's, you know, hopefully going to be released in the not too distant future. And in terms of,
we're always open to ideas. We're always interested in projects, and you know, particularly audio visual, but anything really.
Excellent. Well, it's excellent to hear. So folks listening should go and check out the new album, which is Across the Meridian, which is available now on Domino Records. And for now, Sam and Max, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, James.
Thank you.
You're listening to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy. Time to reflect now as I catch up with Nick Walker, director of the forthcoming Meet Me in the Ruins performance piece, staged within the open space of Coventry Cathedral.
Okay, so I'm propping up the piano somewhere in a back room at the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry, and I'm really pleased to be with Nick Walker. And Nick, you're behind something I think is quite intriguing, which is called Meet Me in the Ruins. Okay, tell me a bit about that.
Well, this was the brainchild of Hamish Glenn, the artistic director here at the Belgrade, and writer Alan Pollock, who is a Coventry-based writer, and also the Coventry Cathedral themselves, who were looking for a piece of work to commemorate 100 years of St Michael's Church, which it was in 1918, becoming Coventry Cathedral. So they invented a festival to celebrate that, the Plumlime Festival, and Meet Me in the Ruins is a theatre commission which is part of that festival. And really what it is a series of encounters. One of the things about the cathedral ruins in Coventry is that it's a very popular place for people to meet. You don't necessarily have to be religious, it's a public space really, and so people come and have their sandwiches there at lunchtime or for a little bit of quiet sitting or for a break or to meet people. And so what we did was commission five writers to write five encounters that happen in the cathedral ruins over the course of its 100-year history. And of course, 50 years of those, it wasn't a ruin. That only happened in 1947. And so we take in encounters at five points in that history of the cathedral and the sort of transforming effect that happens as a result of those conversations.
So they're kind of described, I think, as crossroads or kind of key points throughout the kind of decades of that of those 100 years. So and they're crossroads, I think, in terms of sort of social change and emotional change. Tell me a bit about the kind of some of the themes that you touch on.
That's right. You're exactly right. Yes. The writers have picked five particular points in history. So we've got contemporary Britain, so we start in the current year, but then we also visit encounters that happen in 1987, which obviously was a key year for Coventry in one level, in that the football team won the FA Cup, but also it was a time that was quite a difficult time in Coventry, as it was in many inner cities in the 80s. And we've got a piece set in the 1960s, the early 60s, where the writer Ola Anamashawan is exploring what it's like to be a new visitor to the city from Nigeria. We go to 1947, which is just after the city has been bombed itself. Then we go right back to 1918. So each of those particular resonant points in history, but also the drama itself is about people who are at a bit of a crossroads themselves. They've got a decision to make, or that they're stuck, and as a result of the conversation they have in that particular place, they're able to either get comfort or move on or make a decision, and that's where the drama lies.
And there are, I think, my understanding is there are some what I would call quite challenging stories, stories that have, I guess, real dilemmas. Not, I was going to say dark themes, but they're not necessarily dark. They're just kind of life-changing questions. So there's something I think about hope and kind of surviving a tragedy or part of a tragedy.
Yeah, they're human stories and they're as dark or as light as any human story, really. I mean, there are decisions to make which feel huge but are also very personal. So there are stories about whether a mother decides to keep a child or not. There are stories about whether a return back to a home country is the most sensible thing for their children. There's a story written by Pavan Virk which kicks it off, which is about a young Asian lad who is really suffering as a result of feeling demonized in his own city. And then there's an encounter which is about hope, because someone who's lost somebody in the Second World War is not sure whether she can cope or not, but because of this chance encounter with a Polish soldier, sees a glimmer of light through. And actually, you know, in many ways the sun does catch the cathedral stones and you do get these glimmers of light, so it's stories about that. But yeah, they are big things which are big on a personal level, but it's also something that you won't necessarily be unable to relate to, because everyone has struggles in their life.
And let's talk about the space itself, because the performance, and I think there's some song as well. There's kind of, I'm not sure there's any dance, but there's definitely a bit of song, I think, worked in. But it's described as being site-specific, because obviously you're using the ruins and that space. And that's clever in a way, because I think, you know, you tend to think of ruins as sort of old bits of rock that you have a look at. But, you know, Coventry is a great example, I think, of a place where it's a very lively kind of landmark, isn't it? It is a ruin of a cathedral or part of a cathedral, but it's very lively. You know, it's used as public space. What I was interested in terms of using that space, is it's a great canvas to use, but I guess there are limitations in that?
Well, there are. I mean, there's a lot of theatre that happens in non-theatre spaces, if you like, and actually we've seen more of that over the years. And in Coventry, there's quite a proud tradition of working in sort of, you know, unusual spaces. What you get is that you do get the real resonance of what the space was and is now. There are some technical challenges, of course, so it's outside with all that entails, but strangely, you know, cathedrals have always had some fairly impressive acoustics in it, and even with this ruined one. The acoustics weren't bombed out of it, you know, and actually the you can get quite a sort of intimate sound over quite a large distance, even in the outdoor space. But you're absolutely right, it is a bit of an iconic space for Coventry particularly. It was an important decision that the city planners and the diocese made when they decided to keep the old ruin and build the new one next to it, so that you had that reminder always. And yeah, it's a much loved space in Coventry for that. And actually, as some of the pieces explore, perhaps feels a bit more accessible than going into the main one, although it's often a bit of a gateway into that.
Now let's talk about how local these stories are and how local perhaps some of the writers are who are writing them and some of the performers, because I think what was the kind of recruitment to find those five? Because I imagine that you're kind of inundated with offers or ideas.
There's a huge enthusiasm generally in the city and the Midlands to get involved in culture, and so there are always people wanting to be involved. What we were looking for with this project was to get a balance of Midlands writers whilst at the same time introduce new writers who weren't from the Midlands to Coventry. It's going to be very important for the city to develop a large number of artists as we run up to City of Culture in 2021, and so we were looking inwards to ourselves and the talent that was around, and outwards as well. So that's where we've got our writers from.
Now, also, you are, I think, one of the writers as well as the director. Is that right?
That's right, yes. I was commissioned as a writer initially, but I have directed many things before, and I saw my role in this project as a way of linking all the narratives together. So I didn't want it to be a patchwork piece. I wanted there to be some sort of coherent story that ran alongside it. So I waited for all the other writers to finish their pieces, and then I wrote the linking pieces. But, yeah, there's a blurry line between writing and directing. You know, many writers think performatively, and it doesn't take much to then put it up on its feet. But I've directed here at the Belgrade before, and so I was known as that. And so I think in order to kind of try and get the project as coherent as possible, yeah, they offered me the directing role as well.
Now, you gave me a clue. When I came into the room, you gave me a clue what kind of director you are, which I think is quite a hands-on director, because you're up a platform, waving a board around, and doing all kinds of things. We're looking at a ladder. And some directors, my point in raising that, is some directors are quite detached, aren't they? They want kind of the stage manager or other people to do what they're told.
Well, yes, I mean, everyone has their own style, that's for sure, but I came from a kind of making background, so I was part of a theatre company in Coventry for many years where we made our own work, and often you understand how to do that by putting yourself on your feet or trying things out yourself, and that's the way I like to do it. But it's also one of these ones where at some point the most important decision you can make is with casting it right, because then they take care of themselves. In a way, it gets quite hands-off, actually, just as they find their own way through. And we've got a terrific cast this time round. We're really pleased with the response we got to our audition call-out, and it's a really impressive bunch of actors that we've got for this project.
Does it make being directed more difficult? So if you see what I mean, when you're involved in other projects and other directors sort of, you know, are kind of setting the parameters for you, does that?
Well, I haven't acted myself for a long time, so I don't remember being directed for many years actually. But what I do love is being a writer and seeing how other directors work. It's been fascinating to see that those different styles like you mentioned, and how people get the best out of their project, and the degree of interrogation they give to a brand new script, and what they can make work and what you need to change in the writing. And it's been really lovely to work with directors to see how each one works in a very different kind of way. So I've learned from them, but I haven't been directed myself for years.
Let's just go back to Meet Me in the Ruins. It's coming up very soon on the 6th, 7th and 8th of September. Yep. So that's the kind of Thursday, Friday, Saturday. They're all, I think, about 6:30 in the evening, and performances, except for there's one on Saturday, the 8th of September, which is at 2:30, I think.
Yes.
Is that right? A matinee.
We squeeze a matinee in on the Saturday. So there are four opportunities to catch it, yeah. The light will just be fading at around 6:30 at night. It's sort of early September. We're perhaps all mourning the loss of the light as the sort of autumn heads towards us. They'll all start in the light, and then it'll start to gradually dim, and by the end of the show. And it's about an hour and 15 minutes long, probably, something like that. We should just be seeing the sunset.
And do those performances change? Do they evolve, or are they sort of, I know obviously common structure, but will they change depending on the space and the kind of reaction?
Each performance is always subtly different. We'll be as finished as we can be by the first one, because it's not a long run. So most of the explorations and the changes will happen, you know, in the rehearsal period. But a show is only finished when an audience comes in to see it. So there's always that very exciting dynamic of a new audience for the very first show, but also an opportunity for the performers to learn, you know, how to sort of ride the timings, where the laughs are coming, where the silences are coming, all that sort of stuff. So there will be an evolution over the four shows for sure.
Excellent. And if folks want to get tickets, I think you can Google Meet Me in the Ruins. That's a good way to find it. But also if you go to coventrycathedral.org.uk, you can buy the tickets through that site, I think, somehow.
That's right. Yeah. Do your Googling and then that'll pop up. I think even maybe the tickets are on sale at the Belgrade. So the Belgrade's website should certainly also be able to help you out on that one.
You can access it from wherever.
Yeah. All mobile devices and conventional phones, I think, are possible. Or even coming to the box office in person.
Excellent. Well, Nick, I'll let you back to your busy rehearsal.
Thank you.
And everyone else will scramble back in the room. And we didn't even touch the piano. But for now, thanks very much. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for coming in, James. Cheers. That's great.
Birmingham's a funny place, they said, as I trundled in this direction. And for the next couple of months, it literally is. Birmingham Comedy Festival 2018 kicks off on October the 5th through to Sunday, the 14th of October. As well as many big names, including Rich Hall and Joanna Lumley, the festival will showcase up-and-coming talent through free half-day events and the 2018 Breaking Talent Award. If you can't wait for that, dip into a classic by way of Vacant Lot, a celebration of two lost Tony Hancock scripts brought to life at Stourbridge Town Hall on Wednesday, the 19th of September. For all the colour and detail, go to www.bhamcomfest.co.uk. That's bhamcomfest.co.uk. And we'll be covering some of those great acts and performances in future episodes. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Rob Little, Sam and Max of Pram, Mac Birmingham, Nick Walker, 448 Creative, Belgrade Theatre Coventry, Coventry Cathedral, and Infectious PR. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.